Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Anthony Luzzatto-Gardner, the author of Stars with Stripes, The Essential Partnership Between the European Union and the United States. Published in March by Palgrave Macmillan, this book is a unique guide to the opportunities and threats facing that essential partnership posed by the impending presidential election in November. What makes the book special is that Tony Gardner writes about a core range of bilateral policy topics like trade, data privacy, law enforcement, joint approaches to Russia and Iran, and energy security, but with deep inside knowledge of the issues and the players involved. This is because he served as the Director for European Affairs on President Clinton's National Security Council in 1994 to 1995, and then as President Obama's ambassador to the European Union from 2014 until President Trump's inauguration in January 2017. Tony, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Tim.
You were the 19th U.S. ambassador to the EU, and to my knowledge, none of the others has written a book about the subject or their experience in the job, although I suppose it's entirely possible your successor will write a book about something else. Without Donald Trump's election 4 years ago, do you think you would have written the book at all?
Interesting question. No. As I like to joke, it was a cheap form of therapy. Because I left the day Donald Trump entered the White House. And I was worried then and became steadily more worried over the coming months and indeed years. And I started thinking as I left, I went to the College of Europe and then to the European University Institute. And I started thinking, well, somebody should write a book that reminds people why the United States and the European Union have worked closely together for so long, under both administrations, by the way. And then pretty soon I decided, well, actually, that person should be me, because I don't want to write an academic book. I want to write a book that is a perspective of someone from the trenches who's lived it and who's breathed it for a long time. So that's why I did it.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, she once described famously the United States as the indispensable nation. With your book subtitle, The Essential Partnership, were you trying to capture a sort of similar concept?
Well, I still think that, yes, the United States is in a unique position to lead. That certainly does not mean that the United States has all the answers and always behaves appropriately, and we've seen ample evidence to the contrary, in fact, during the last 3.5 years, unfortunately. Obviously, the United States does make serious mistakes and sometimes jumps the rails. But given its position, its power, its influence, its breadth, scope, we do have a unique ability to lead. And even critics of the United States, of which there are many, I think many of them would agree that a world that is led by the Chinese or led by the Russians would be a far, far grimmer, more dangerous, inhospitable place. So, you know, I am confident, Tim, that we will go back to, we won't wind back the clock, but we will go back to the days when, yes, we believed in working with allies. Yes, we believed in working within the contours of the rules and the institutions. True, I mean, track record wasn't always perfect, but we did believe in supporting, upholding the basic institutions that we, the U.S. and Europe, built after the Second World War. So I think we will go back to those years, and there's a lot to be done.
Yeah, in fact, you end the book by warning that the, as you say, like the third generation of the characters in Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, mm-hmm. that the US and the EU of today are in danger of, quote, gambling away their inheritance. Do you, as we approach election day, do you feel more or less reassured of that warning? Of that warning not being fulfilled.
Well, that's why I threw myself into the campaign, Tim. I really wasn't looking to do it, frankly. I had been involved in a number of campaigns, both Obama campaigns, extremely time consuming. But when I saw what was at stake, a lot is at stake. And I honestly believe, and I don't feel that I'm exaggerating, I feel the future of American democracy is at stake. Mm-hmm. And I think Joe Biden said it correctly. The soul of the country is on the ballot. And not only that, the future of whether or not we can deal with climate change, the future of race relations in the United States, the future of whether we destroy or not, you know, undermine our allies in a really fundamental way. So many things are at stake today in the ballot. I'm confident, not just based on the polls, which often are wrong, I'm confident that Joe Biden stands a good chance of winning. But even if he does win, Tim, there is no illusion in the Biden camp. You know, and I'm working away on a number of groups, policy groups, that there's no illusion that time will be short and pressure will be really high to prove the case to the American people, particularly that the way of doing business, as I said, with allies, within the rules, within the institutions, is a better way than acting unilaterally and undermining those rules and institutions. That is going to be so important, because if we fail, should Joe Biden win, if we fail to make that case, I do believe that a more virulent, nasty form of demagogic populism could come back. And there we would squander the inheritance.
Yes, in that respect, and tying this into the relationship with Europe, You write that the experience of Trump and of Brexit actually have, as you say, served as a mighty vaccine against Euroscepticism. And as I was reading the book, I thought, actually, maybe they've done more than that. Do you think that they, and especially Russian interference in support of the American right, have re-educated much of the American, European and British left and centre-left about the enduring value of the post-war democratic institutions like the EU, like NATO, like the Transatlantic Alliance? So do you think, in a sense, President Biden, if that's what we're going to see in January, is going to be pushing at a more open door than he would have done before the Trump experience?
Well, I think there's a lot in what you say, because we were taking many of these things for granted. Partly because of so many years that divide us between the events of the Second World War, that, you know, often those ritual incantations, so to speak, of, you know, the war and common values were greeted with collective yawns. But we're seeing just how relevant all of this is. Look, we just had armed far-right militias plotting to take hostage a governor of a major state in the United States. Now, if you told me that 5 years ago, I would have said absolutely impossible. If you had told me just one of the many thousands of things that Donald Trump has done or said, including his antics on the balcony of the White House, which frankly remind me of, tin pot dictators around the world, I would have said it's impossible. Many of us were naive, Tim, including me, by the way. When Obama was elected, we thought, well, this seals, you know, this represents a final turning point in the United States in terms of race relations. We've overcome the ghosts of the past. And in fact, we have not. We're still on a very long journey. So all of these events, the street violence, these antics, this far-right language, this threat of bringing out some of these groups onto the streets to contest an election. Mm. Remember, President Trump has said he has refused to say for the first time in history that he would represent, he would recognize the results of a free and democratic election. Yeah. This is a wake-up call to a lot of people, not maybe to his core base, his really core base, but to a lot of Americans, I think it is scary. And we have to remember, and this is perhaps a positive wake-up, Tim, we have to remember that the United States is capable of slipping, like other countries around the world, into this vortex. You know, as a kid in high school, I would learn history about other countries and how they lost their democratic institutions. And I thought, well, that's all very well, but that applies to other countries. It could never happen here because the United States is somehow different. Our democratic institutions are stronger. And yet we're seeing some of our institutions buckle, not to collapse, but buckle under the strain. And my concern is that after four more years, I'm not entirely sure that our judiciary and our media and our other restraints on executive power will actually be able to survive.
Mm. Wouldn't you argue, though, or is there not a case for saying that the weakest link in that respect has been Congress, that the judiciary have largely held up, the media have certainly held up?
Yes.
Do you think you're maybe not stretching the argument a little? By suggesting that the institutions have failed.
So far, you're right. I think the judiciary has held up. But another 4 years of judicial appointments across the board, from the Supreme Court to the federal bench and so on, things will look a bit different. And if the only means of making those appointments is, you know, fealty to Donald Trump, I start getting worried. When people are appointed just because they agree with a specific litmus test set by this president, I start to worry. The media has held up even under harassment, and it shows great courage. So I really respect the members of the press who have held up under withering attacks. You're right, Congress, I'm very disappointed. Because this is not a partisan issue. When these topics are at stake, you know, the race relations and the basic standards of decency for a president in the White House, I would have expected more members of the other party to stand up and say, this is simply unacceptable behavior from a president of the United States. And that is not a partisan statement to make. Too few members of Congress, both House and Senate, have actually done that on the Republican side.
Yes. I mean, you said there that this, if Joe Biden is elected, it will be the reassuring people in the existing institutions will be absolutely critical. And recently, apart from your book, I read John Bolton's The Room Where It Happened. And there's a lot of surprising things in that book, but the part that really jumped out at me was Trump's obsession with the 2% NATO spending target and his refusal to get past the idea that the Europeans, in his mind, the Germans were not paying their dues, as he put it. You discuss this issue in the book of European underspending and inefficient military spending. But do you think there's an understanding in Washington and in the European capitals that this issue must absolutely be addressed during the next 4 years, or it could be terminal for NATO?
Sure, there's an understanding of it. You know, this issue is not new. Donald Trump likes to pretend it's new. It's been discussed, not just discussed, but, you know, pressed as a very important issue by prior presidents, including Obama. And he, by the way, they did make some progress, not enough. But made some progress with the European allies. But of course, it's not correct, not right, for Germany particularly to be spending well beneath the 2% threshold, when by increasing toward that threshold, they could make a material difference to European not only spending, but its readiness. A couple of points I make in the book, Tim. First, it's not just the amount of spending, it's how the money is spent. And that's where also Europe really falls woefully short. And I hope I don't pick on poor Belgium, a country I love. I've lived there for 6 years of my life. But it's an extreme case where 70% of the money it spends goes to pensions and salaries and sort of soft stuff, not on kit and things that are relevant for the battlefield. And you start doing the math, as I did in the book, you end up with some just ridiculous numbers. So 1% of 550 billion GDP, roughly, you can do the math, 5.5, and of that, 70% on pensions and salaries. Of course, those figures make people in the United States extremely angry. And this will not go away as an issue, and I'm quite sure that Joe Biden would press this. Now, the second point, however, Tim, I have to make here, while this is an important topic, one has to see burden sharing in the round. I think I make this point also in the book. Now, Donald Trump sees the world always in totally black and white ways. There's no gray anywhere. He doesn't consider that Europe does shoulder an outsized share of burdens in areas like combating climate change, in dealing with a migration crisis, when the United States bears an undersized burden on those two topics, certainly under Donald Trump's watch. So I would just simply say this, look, we should consider burden sharing as a much bigger concept than just how much money we spend on defense.
Yes, and he's constantly talking about how the EU has done nothing in Ukraine, which of course is the exact opposite of the truth. You know the people in Joe Biden's national security and foreign policy team. If he wins in November, how much of a priority will repairing this relationship be compared to, say, dealing with China? And do you think he will commit heavyweight officials, i.e. not people like Sondland or Ted Malik or whatever, to this effort?
Absolutely, yes. I have no doubt in my mind that as you said, I know the team, the foreign policy team, extremely well, some of them going back many decades, and I know Joe Biden, I've worked with him. Europe will be a priority because it is important in of itself across all of the issues I describe in my book, so not just military, but, you know, for trade, for data privacy, for digital, for energy security, for issue of sanctions, and law enforcement, and climate change, so on, a lot of issues. But also, you mentioned China because we need to work with our partners, above all, the European Union, to leverage our joint influence with regard to China. And, you know, when we look at the priorities of the next 4 years, China is perhaps number one. And we will have to show real progress in getting the Chinese to change their behavior in some areas, particularly in trade. And yes, I think it is doable. Now, the fact that we have spurned the European Union in trying to do that, meaning reforming the WTO and getting the Chinese to change some of their abusive trade behavior, is bizarre. It's bizarre because there has been no understanding in this administration of the relevance, importance, and indeed power of the European Union in this regard. That is going to change day one. I guarantee you, one of the first things I think the administration will do, sit down with the European Union and say, okay, here's how we want the WTO to be reformed. Here are our ideas. We've seen your ideas. They've been published in a white paper. Let's act in a coordinated fashion to get some of this done.
Yeah. And I note that you say sit down with the European Union. Again, as you point out in the book, it's not always easy to find out who to sit down with at the European Union. Who would you prioritize in that kind of diplomatic effort?
Well, look, there are some areas, as you well know, most of the listeners will know, that where the Commission, representing the EU, has sole power, competence in EU jargon, horrible word, but sole power, trade is one of them. And so it is, in fact, DG Trade that will be a core partner for us. Now, of course, some member states are going to be critical in this exercise. They're the obvious ones. But here it's the European Commission that is the partner. And I think it will be a willing partner on trade and reforming trade, because they know just as well as we do. We have an opportunity in the next 4 years to save the system. And if we don't, it'll collapse, because there'll be a growing sense that the rules are just not fit for purpose and the Chinese are just abusing them. And then things fall apart and we both face populist backlash. So it is super important. And by the way, there's a lot that we can do bilaterally, which I've written about, I've proposed to the campaign, and I think we can do them in the first 100 days. So yes, we're ready to go. We, you know, policies are ready for day one, first 100 days, first year. And if I could just take a few more minutes, you know, there are two core thoughts that are informing and shaping the work of all these working groups. The first is what is actionable, fast, and meaningful. So no academic exercises, you know, pass muster here. We're not going to set up lots of new high-level working groups and institutions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what can actually be done quickly and is relatively uncontroversial? So I've done a number of papers identifying those areas with the EU. Second, how do we identify in concrete ways what a foreign policy for the middle class looks like, particularly in trade? And third, as I already mentioned before, more broadly, how do we make the case domestically to the skeptics about multilateralism that this is not shackling our power and our influence, but indeed is a way that can help us achieve our objectives? And by the way, this is a theme that I would like to see in this country, in the UK, spoken about more often. The idea that belonging to institutions and following the laws and belonging to association groups of nations somehow undermines your sovereignty is completely incorrect.
Your chapter on the TTIP, on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, is particularly interesting, I think, not just in terms of the detail, but you give the impression that the whole project felt doomed, really, given the fact that European officials were saying one thing and politicians were saying another, and that President Obama, for many reasons, was quite focused on the TPP in Asia. First of all, is that a fair characterization of what you said? And secondly, what are the chances that TTIP gets revived under Biden?
Well, Tim, it's a fair characterization indeed. It was too broad. We were too ambitious. We're not going to make that mistake again. So no, there's zero chance of resuscitating TTIP in its old form. We made a lot of mistakes on both sides, and I described them in the chapter in some detail. But I remain hopeful that there are bits of that agenda that can be implemented pretty quickly. And one of them is, not surprisingly, elimination of tariffs on industrial goods trade, which is a significant number, a significant percentage. It leaves aside some of the very sensitive agricultural line items. But that is economically meaningful. I think we can get it done. I think it's uncontroversial. I think, true, politically, we will need to see some progress on agricultural issues, particularly on the so-called plant and animal health and safety, the sanitary and phytosanitary provisions, where we've been battling each other for sometimes decades with very little progress. It's, as I describe it, a hostage exchange exercise. The EU understands also that we will need to see some progress there. And I think we can. There are other bits where I believe we can make some progress. Some of the regulatory cooperation, I think we can see progress, for example, on non-safety aspects of automobile trade. And a few other areas, but we need to scale it down dramatically and show we can make progress right away. Oh, and by the way, I think we can resolve the Boeing Airbus dispute.
Would you expect that to be done as a package or as a number of different groups working on different sectoral areas?
Well, you know, the old idea of these things is you need to tie everything up in one big bundle. But The bigger the bundle, I also see the bigger the cross linkages and the more delay. We really cannot afford delay. You know, if we win, I hope and believe we can sit down quickly with you, with the commission and say, look, literally the weight of history is on our shoulders, and we got to get this stuff done. So perhaps not, you know, formally linked, but an understanding that we need to get a number of things accomplished. And it would come, by the way, with, I'm pretty sure, lifting of these unilateral sanctions against Europe on steel and aluminum and lifting of the counter sanctions. Those sanctions should never have been implemented. They were implemented on bogus grounds. I think it's embarrassing for the United States who have done them to argue, as we did, essentially, that imports of steel and aluminum from our allies at a time of peace represent a threat to our national security. Now, the reason that's so dangerous, Tim, is that when you start engaging in these bogus pretexts and invoking national security when there really aren't true national security concerns, then surprise, surprise, other countries will invoke the same to achieve their own objectives. And in fact, Russia has done so, Saudi Arabia have done so, and perhaps other countries, I'm not aware. And therein lies the way of the jungle, very simply. Now, the belief that some Americans have that that's fine because we are the 600-pound gorilla and we will survive the best in the jungle is just wrong. Mm-hmm. Because we, like the UK, do actually rely on a world of rules and institutions for many things, not only our exports, but it's just wrong to say we can live in a jungle happily. And that's the case we need to show.
And while you're doing these negotiations, would you expect to do parallel negotiations with the UK? And would you attempt to try and do broadly the same kind of negotiations to try and repair some of the damage of the Brexit process?
So I'm a believer in these negotiations. Now, I never thought they would get done in weeks or months or even a few years, as many pundits were saying after Donald Trump's election. Remember, there were many people who took to the airwaves and saying, we're going to get a big, bold, beautiful trade deal. It's oven ready. It'll be done. Nonsense. None of these people had ever seen a trade deal done. I don't think anyone had ever touched one. Honestly, it was so irritating to hear this. So here we are. It hasn't been done. Is it important? Yes. And I do think that, you know, although the economic impact of this deal by the studies done on both sides of the Atlantic shows it's not going to be terribly significant, but it's important. It's important because we can do things in a US-UK deal that probably are simpler than a US-EU deal. I'm thinking of even recognition of some professional qualifications potentially. I think a digital chapter could be bolder or more ambitious than one with the EU for all the reasons that are, I think, obvious. I think on agricultural trade, we can probably go faster, although we will be hemmed in some aspects by the withdrawal deal, for example, with regard to geographical indications. But I think on the issue of, I'm not talking about hormone beef, by the way, where there's a lot of opposition in the UK, but, you know, potentially on GMOs, I think there is a greater relaxation in this country with regard to that. On promotion of small and medium-sized enterprises and their exports across the Atlantic, there's lots that we can do that's meaningful.
Would you expect them to be done in parallel? And for that, actually, do you... would the USTR get a single fast-track authority to do both? Or in fact, would that be required?
Well, it's interesting because, this coming up for renegotiation in April. So it's a major issue. Would we be able to wrap this up so quickly, before April? That's a big question mark. I just can't give an opinion because I'm not close enough to where it stands now. I'm somewhat skeptical because, a new administration... January 20th, it's going to take several months for the new team to get its feet under the table. Mm-hmm. And then you have a new TPA. And that's a long exercise of negotiating with Congress right there. So, would we need approval from Congress? My understanding is that for certainly a free trade agreement, we would. For something like eliminating tariffs on industrial goods trade with the EU, my understanding is that this could be done without. But I'm not. That's my understanding. So there are things that we can do without getting TPA.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. I have one tangential question, but an interesting one nevertheless for me. Realistically, do you think a President Biden could make Vladimir Putin pay for his behavior over the last 5 years?
I certainly hope so, Tim. Oh, the wonderful things that we could do. Wonderful things that we should have done. And it's one of the areas that I can even say, disappointed that we didn't do. And these are sometimes things that are not always identified. And by that, I mean not just these pinpricks of travel bans or asset freezes, which true for certain people are perhaps create problems. But much more than that, we can embarrass the hell out of him by publicizing information about the depth of the cronyism and corruption in and around his circle. And even during the Ukraine war, I'd made a proposal that the names of all the Russian soldiers who died fighting on Ukrainian soil be published, because the Kremlin went to extraordinary lengths to try to hide the fact that there were, in fact, Russian soldiers fighting and dying on Ukrainian soil. I certainly hope we would consider all of the options, and indeed he should pay. He has not only interfered in our elections, he's done much more than that. He's tried to do to not only sow discord and undermine our democracies, but I believe this has been a campaign of targeted assassinations on European soil, including in the United Kingdom. Now, the fact that we have engaged in such limited retaliation, I think, is fairly depressing. Honestly, fairly depressing to think that the European Union has not been capable, together with the United States, of going much further. Now, I am heartened that the EU apparently is going to pass a form of the Magnitsky Act that covers human rights violations. And it should go much broader. It shouldn't just be human rights violations. It should be, corruption, acts of corruption. We should be much more robust in our response to the Kremlin.
You talk about this several times in the book about European reticence in dealing with Russia because he could switch the energy off at any time, but B, the outsized influence he had in places like Cyprus, which, as we've seen again during the Belarus affair. But do you think that with different politics coming from Washington, that could embolden the Europeans more over the next few years regarding Russia?
Well, it's not going to be easy, for sure. I was a witness to that, because there are always going to be reasons, different reasons, commercial reasons, as you say, or links, financial links with Russia. Or in the case of Hungary, it's a fact that they've signed up to, Russian help with their reactors and so forth. There are going to be always a host of different issues. But during the last 4 years, we've had a president of the United States who has gone to extraordinary lengths to defend, to explain Vladimir Putin. That's not, that's not going to continue. So a change of administration, as you say, in Washington will, I think, help to stiffen the backbones across most of the 27. Some will resist or find reasons not to proceed. But we were successful, Tim, in a way that exceeded most people's expectations in rolling out simultaneously a pretty tough package of sanctions because of the invasion of Ukraine and rolled it over every 6 months. And that was despite all the issues we've just mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. Cyprus and Italy and, pleading for a special understanding for its oil company or Hungary or even France and even Germany. So it was across the board. We were successful in doing that. So we could probably be successful again.
Actually, in that respect, do you think a change of leadership I mean, she's been incredibly successful and remains incredibly popular, but do you think a change of leadership in Christian democracy in Germany next year could make a difference in that respect?
Well, certainly her passing, you know, Angela Merkel's passing from the scene is a critical event. I have no reason to believe that Germany will in any way be a less important partner. It will still be pivotal. It will still be Berlin at the center, as I witnessed. And more so, by the way, now that the UK is close to being out. And one of the reasons why the Obama administration thought that Brexit was not a good idea for the United States and for the solidity of Europe is that the UK served, if you will, as a third leg in a triad, sort of unofficially. Everyone keeps talking about the Franco-German motor, but the UK was playing in a critical role. Now we have a duo, but a duo in which really one partner is so much more influential and economically more important. And that is not a healthy recipe long-term. And I think even the Germans would recognize this. This is not the way that European construction was supposed to be. So Berlin will continue even more so to be at the center under new leadership.
Yeah. One final question. You quote Tom Friedman as saying that putting the words European Union in a book title is as good as adding do not read. How's your experience been with the book this year?
Well, you know, COVID hasn't helped him, so everything's done virtually.
Well, we're all doing a lot more reading.
We're doing more reading, yes. And the events, I think, have raised awareness, concern about Europe to the front, the front level. But of course, not being able to do book tours physically has been an impediment. Mm-hmm. But look, I've done about 40 Zoom book launches. Mm-hmm. Some of them pretty well attended. I had no great expectations about book sales because this is a pretty, limited issue, at least for some. But I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did it for the fact that we will have to rediscover at some point the importance of this relationship. And I hope the time comes sooner rather than later and that we do send, qualified people. I'm quite confident we will to represent the United States and keep posts, including mission to the EU. And that, it's a record that reminds people, and this is important, it's not just a trade relationship. Many people think, US, EU, we just talk about trade. And, we hit ourselves over the head about chlorinated chicken and so on. Well, no. Mm-hmm. It's so much broader than that. And I try to capture that in the book. There's some areas that some people, even relative experts, might be surprised to know about. The depth of our relationship, for example, on law enforcement. I was surprised. I went to Europol 3 times under my watch, and I didn't know the depth of our relationship. Even on military issues, where some people would entirely dismiss the EU as completely irrelevant, there's some important stuff going on. And so forth. So there's a lot to do. And we haven't really talked about climate change. And this is probably a good way to end this, Tim. Mm. I do describe in some detail, going back to the 70s, actually, quickly in my book, how the U.S. and the EU were out of sync with each other for a long time. First, the U.S. was leading, in fact, in those years on ozone issues. And then we separated paths under the Bush years and so forth. Then under Obama, fast forward, we had the disaster of Copenhagen. And under 8 years, we were more or less in sync and we co-sponsored, we co-led, and we together got an achievement. We got the Paris Accords over the line. And now, of course, 4 years we've lost. Now, we have an opportunity, we have a window now of incredible importance to work together with the Chinese. You saw Xi Jinping's recent statement about capping out carbon emissions and to be carbon neutral by 2060. We have an opportunity to go back to the table and in fact, we were going to have to make our objectives even more ambitious because we have a deeper hole to dig out of. This, I would put as issue probably number one, together with dealing with China. saving the planet together, US and the EU. We are core essential partners in getting that done.
Okay, well, today, Tony Gardner and I have been discussing his book, Stars with Stripes, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Tony, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks very much, Tim.